This will be going on over the next 2 weeks. It'll be the highest level of sanctions by the time it's finished over a two-week period.
More pressure is aimed at North Korea. It's Wednesday, November 22nd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, Cambodian fishing at risk, Harvard under scrutiny about Asian students. It's all on today's VOA Asia. South Korea and Japan Tuesday welcomed the United States announcement that it was putting North Korea back on its list of state sponsors of terrorism, a move, a South Korean foreign ministry spokesman said, is part of the international effort to denuclearize Pyongyang peacefully. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman described the situation as complicated and sensitive and called on all parties to return to the correct path of negotiation, dialogue, and consultation. President Donald Trump, in making the announcement from the White House, said reinstating North Korea on the list after being removed in 2008 should have been done a long time ago.
In addition to threatening the world by nuclear devastation, North Korea has repeatedly supported acts of international terrorism, including assassinations on foreign soil. This designation will impose further sanctions and penalties on North Korea and related persons and supports our maximum pressure campaign to isolate the murderous regime that you've all been reading about and in some cases writing about. Tomorrow, the Treasury Department will be announcing an additional sanction and a very large one on North Korea, and this will be going on over the next 2 weeks. It'll be the highest level of sanctions by the time it's finished over a two-week period. The North Korean regime must be lawful. It must end its unlawful nuclear and ballistic missile development and cease all support for international terrorism, which it is not doing.
The North was first put on the terrorism list following the downing of a Korean Air passenger jet in 1987 with the loss of 115 lives. It was taken off by the Bush administration as the North began implementing a nuclear disarmament agreement. Critics contend it will only incite North Korea to engage in a provocative behavior, undercut efforts to get China's cooperation in reining in Pyongyang, and do little to encourage dialogue. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Tufts University Assistant Professor of Korean Studies, Sung-Yoon Lee, if he believes it's a good move.
Yes, because there's been a very strong movement within Congress to get the administration to relist North Korea as a state sponsor of terrorism. You know, Trump's announcement during this week of a major holiday in the United States with Thanksgiving Day just looming, it gives North Korea the excuse to conduct another major weapons test and then to deflect blame onto the United States, to do something North Korea would have done anyway and lay the blame on the U.S. North Korea will say this is a provocation, it's unacceptable. But the question is, does this act have beyond symbolic opprobrium? Does it have real practical financial costs? And I would say, decidedly, yes.
So there is an upside to this argument?
Yes, there is. First of all, North Korea never should have been taken off the list when it was during the Bush administration in 2008. That removal of North Korea from the list was in return for Pyongyang's illusory promise of denuclearization and full compliance with inspections requirements. We know none of that has come into fruition. What are the practical benefits of relisting North Korea? Well, from now, any bank that seeks to process dollar transactions using U.S. dollar denominations on behalf of a North Korean entity is now required to apply for a Treasury Department license. It adds an added layer of deterrence, whereas before the relisting, a bank that may be suspicious that this is a shady deal with North Korea will most likely blithely just go on and do it, ignore it, and will probably be able to fly under the radar. Now, if a bank is found to have willfully violated U.S. laws, then conceivably the United States will at some point levy a major fine on that bank on the scale of BNP Paribas, the biggest French bank, which was fined almost $9 billion for violating this kind of general licensing requirements with respect to Iran, Sudan, and Cuba. So, you know, it's not merely symbolic. It has real financial costs on North Korea's business partners. Moreover, any public corporation that has investments in North Korea are now required to disclose their investments in public filings. What does that do? Probably not much in the short term.
Sung-Yun Lee said the relisting of Pyongyang will make Chinese banks and state-owned enterprises more careful and circumspect in their business dealings with North Korea. Chinese envoy Sung Tao ended a four-day trip to North Korea Monday, a visit some thought might include a stern warning from President Xi Jinping over nuclear tensions. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Myanmar's Aung San Suu Kyi hopes for Rohingya agreement with Bangladesh. Pakistan welcomes U.S. offer to prevent militant raids from Afghanistan. China sentences rights lawyer to 2 years in prison. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Cambodia's Tonle Sap Lake, which lies in the center of the country, is home to hundreds of species of fish that provide the Southeast Asian nation with up to 60% of its protein. But the lake's rich fishery is at risk because of overfishing, pollution, and hydroelectric dams. VOA's Amy Katz narrates this report by Kevin Enix.
The Tonle Sap is a seasonal freshwater lake that shrinks and grows by thousands of kilometers with the seasons. It is home to hundreds of species of fish and yields as much as 300,000 tons of fish every year. But that is changing.
In the past, we would catch lots of fish using our nets, but now there are so many people fishing here that we are not catching much anymore. That means we are making far less fish paste than before. Yes, and now the water level is high again, but it smells really bad, and as I said, there is not as much fish as before.
The reasons why are common to many of the world's bodies of water. Overfishing is reducing fish stock, spawning grounds are disappearing, and hydroelectric dams stopping the natural migration of some fish species. And the problem could get worse.
There are plans to build more dams upstream in Laos. In Cambodia, we already have a dam. We are worried the electric dams will affect the fish migration and reproduction rates. The dams have also slowed down the rate of water flowing into the lake and affect the water quality in the Mekong River.
The problem is twofold, because not only are there fewer fish to feed Cambodians, but there are more people relying on fishing to make their living. And the lake is dying. In 2016, environmental groups named Tonle Sap the world's most threatened lake. Government agencies say they are doing what they can.
We are continuing to work with the fishermen in the region to try to fix the problems. We've had many meetings with the parties. Just this morning, we filed our latest report with the Ministry of Environment, and soon they will be discussing with us what we should do.
The fear is not only will there not be enough food, but in coming years, smaller catches will cause a migration crisis as thousands of people who make their living on the lake head to cities looking for work. For Kevin Enix, Amy Katz, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi expressed hope Tuesday for reaching an agreement with Bangladesh on the return of Rohingya Muslims who have fled to Bangladesh in the past 3 months. She said work is progressing on a memorandum of understanding for the refugees' quote, safe and voluntary return. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thank you so much for joining us today. The U.S. Justice Department has threatened to sue Harvard University to force it to turn over documents as it investigates whether the Ivy League school's admission policies violate civil rights laws by discriminating against Asian American applicants. We hear more from VOA Asia's Ira Melman.
The Justice Department is probing the school's compliance with Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that according to a letter seen by several news organizations setting a December 1st deadline for Harvard to hand over documents on its admission policies. The Justice Department cited a 2015 lawsuit that charges Harvard's affirmative action policies that they do discriminate against Asian American applicants. Joining us is Ilya Shapiro, a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Washington-based Cato Institute. Ilya, thanks for joining us. How do Harvard's admission policies discriminate against Asian Americans?
Well, we don't know exactly, which is part of the problem. The lawsuits that were filed by an organization called Students for Fair Admissions in 3 years ago, November 2014, talk about statistical evidence that suggests that there's racial quotas or an attempt in any event to limit the number of Asians that are admitted. People of a similar academic qualification, you have to be many more times qualified if you're Asian versus if you're white, and then if you're Latino, black, there are different rates based on different races. But we just don't know whether Harvard's method of getting to that strange result, what it is. It's a black box, and so there's been an attempt by that lawsuit and now by the Justice Department at getting information at exactly how Harvard uses race, because the Supreme Court has said there are ways of doing it that's constitutional and there are ways of doing it that are not.
Well, the school has maintained for a long time now that its admission policies are fully compliant with U.S. laws, and they've worked to increase the amount of financial aid it offers to ensure economic as well as racial diversity in its classes. That's not enough?
Assurances are nice, but I'll trust Harvard about as far as I can throw it. And I don't just say that because I went to a different Ivy League institution, but the history of Harvard has had quotas, racial quotas, ethnic quotas of various kinds over the years. And so as the Asian American population in America has grown and the caliber and quality of student applicants has increased, we haven't seen a change over decades in any of the Ivy League schools, frankly, even if we have seen growth in California and certain other very good and selective institutions. So we really won't know until the documents come out, either to the Justice Department or in this litigation. But simple assurances are not enough, and the Supreme Court has said so.
Well, we have tried to contact both the Department of Justice and Harvard for reactions, and they have not replied to our request. What would your headline be on this?
I think there's a lot of misinformation about what affirmative action is. A lot of people think that all it is that if you have two equally qualified candidates, okay, let's give the nod to the historically disadvantaged minority or something like that. But it's just not. The types of advantages that are being given purely on race, not any other characteristic at all, is astonishing. It's generally in these highly selective schools worth more than being a violin virtuoso or Olympic athlete or things like this. And that's a conversation that we should be having about who exactly benefits from these sorts of racial preferences.
Ilya Shapiro is a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute, also editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Ilya, thanks so much for trying to clear this up for us.
My pleasure. Take care.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We'd like to say hello to everyone listening on the radio in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, Helps Radio at Help University. Thanks so much for tuning in today. You can also find us on Facebook at VOA Asia, which is a great place to send us a message. Why don't you go online and do that? Or you can send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. We'd love to hear from you and find out what you're up to in your part of the world. We also thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Dave Magnus, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Byrd on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.